This all started in museums and galleries. Now it's in classrooms, in country towns.
This should not be here.
It's a human being in a box.
This is the stuff of empires.
There is a great betrayal.
We're not slaves, we're African.
It's the stuff the British stole.
I just don't believe that. It just does not stand up.
From ABC Australia and CBC Podcasts, 6 brand new podcast episodes for free worldwide, available now on CBC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hey, I'm Tom Power. Welcome to Q. So when you watch like American media or like follow American news, you often hear people say, you know, the country is so incredibly divided. The country is so incredibly polarized. And you even see the odd headline of commentators asking like, could we be on our way to another American Civil War? So Alex Garland's new film could not be coming out at a more interesting time. It's called Civil War, and it's about just that. A modern day, like in this time, American Civil War, set just like a few years from now. The thing is, it's never specifically clearly stated in the film why the Civil War is happening. You know, there's a president with sort of fascist tendencies. He's disbanded the FBI. He's attacking American citizens. We know that Texas and California have joined up as the Western forces with this major military capability.
What do you think the route's going to be like?
There's nothing direct. The interstates are vaporized, and you can't get anywhere near Philly. So you got to go west, maybe as far as Pittsburgh, then circle in from West Virginia.
So when you watch the trailer to the film, you start to think, oh, this is going to be a film about how polarized we are and the dangers it could lead to. But Alex really sees the film as a love letter to journalism. He grew up with a political cartoonist, like a major political cartoonist in the UK. As a dad, he was surrounded by journalists. He even says in this conversation for the first time, actually, that he thought about being, he tried to become a foreign correspondent for a while. But he ended up becoming an author. He wrote this book called The Beach, which became a big hit, and then a movie with Leonardo DiCaprio in it. And then he went on to make movies like 28 Days Later, Ex Machina, Annihilation. And Alex came in for a conversation about Civil War, and it led to a really interesting chat on his thoughts on journalism and the media, about how you see yourself changing politically as you get older, and why he wants this film to be a warning. Here's my conversation with Alex Garland. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
Congratulations on the film.
I appreciate that very much, thank you.
Was there an image or a scene or something that inspired you to start thinking about this?
No, not really. It was a kind of growing ambient sense of concern that I think was shared by a lot of people. And it came in lots and lots of different areas. It came from different areas. And it was a bit like a noise level that just sort of increasingly grew more and more and more intense. And at a certain point, the noise level just spat itself out for me as a screenplay. And the concerns, I thought, were quite broadly shared. I could see them being reflected in journalism, amongst friends, amongst family, almost in casual conversations in shops or in a pub or anywhere. And they were concerns loosely based around stuff to do with polarization and division and, you know, all that stuff.
Loosely, what you were hearing was, we seem more divided than ever. Things are getting really tough.
It's not even seems we are just objectively more divided. I think it is a problem in several countries as well. It's not located in one place. The film is set in America. I could have set it in the UK. There's various European countries, Middle Eastern, Asian, South American. There's something happening. It's not secret. It's in plain sight. It's widely discussed, widely talked about. I think for me, it had an added element, which was to do with distrust in the press, distrust in journalism. And a thought that occurred to me that I kept turning around in my head, which is, if Woodward and Bernstein and the Washington Post, who brought down Nixon with reporting, if that was happening today in my country or in America or some of the other countries I've alluded to, would that bring down the president or the prime minister? And evidently it wouldn't. because similar scale stories were being reported, in effect, with no consequence, no traction. And there was something really strange about that for me, because, you know, the Fourth Estate is a check and balance on corrupt governments.
Why did you set it in America when you could have set it in the UK or anywhere?
I certainly could have set it in America. In the UK, I could spell out the reasons. But America is by far and away the biggest, most powerful, most influential country in the world. And my way of visualizing it is a mattress. The world is a mattress. If my country rolls over on the mattress, it's like a dog or a cat rolling over on the mat. Nothing happens. If America rolls over, the whole mattress shifts. And there is a radiating effect from American politics. There's also antagonism. It's dislike. You have politicians going out of their way to undermine trust in the media mm-hmm. because the media threatens them and holds them to account. If an institution is trusted, you know, by its choir, it's preaching to a choir because it's trying to maintain that choir because it needs the advertising revenue to do that. But it becomes increasingly distrusted by all the other choirs, and conversely, it's working the other way as well. You end up with a generalized feeling of antagonism towards the press that is not just often unjustified, it's unwise. So that was definitely another of the big motivating factors behind this film.
So why did you tell the story in some ways through the lens of experience of journalists? You have one character in this film, I should let people know who haven't seen it, Lee, who's played by Kirsten Dunst. She's a photographer, a war photographer, a war journalist, a foreign correspondent who's been around for a little while. She's seen some stuff. And then you have Jesse, who's just starting out and wanting to get involved. What was interesting to you about seeing this through the lens of experience?
What it really was I wanted reporters. I wanted reporters of different generations, and some towards the end of their career and life, some just beginning and some in the mid-state. There's Stephen McKinley Henderson, older New York Times journalist.
Been around for a while. Yeah.
Then there's two agency journalists, Reuters, Kirsten Dunst and Wagner Moura. And then there's a young freelancer
starting out, played
by Kaylee Spaney. But in a way, they're not representing different kinds of media organization. They're representing different phases of life and in response to the problems that they're facing.
Help me understand that better. What do you mean by that?
So, number one, they're reporters. It's an old-fashioned form of journalism which is deliberately trying to remove bias. And the film is trying to function like a reporter itself. So it's trying to remove its own bias and just showing you a sequence of events in the way a journalist would. Some of the reporters, the Kirsten Dunst character in particular, what they've done is they are a kind of journalist, which is a journalist that probably works as a foreign correspondent generally, but has covered conflict, who is the sharp end of journalism in some respects, or one of the sharp ends of journalism, where they are putting themselves in physical danger. They require physical courage in order to do what they do. Mm-hmm. One of the things about a photographer is they can't photograph it without being able to see it. Mm-hmm. So if they are photographing conflict, they need to be in the conflict.
Yeah.
And they pay a price for that psychologically, internally. Mm-hmm. They have to face stuff and witness things and carry those things and, as I said, put themselves in danger. But they do it for a reason. And the reason may carry contradictions. It may be to get a scoop. It may be careerist. But it's also because they believe in something. Mm-hmm. They believe in a principle to do with the press. Mm-hmm. And they are risking their life for that. But if you're going to risk your life, it has to be for a purpose. Mm-hmm. And the purpose is to warn, to show in a way that journalism was once very good at. Vietnam is a good example of a war that was covered by journalism and showed people back home what the reality of war was like, and led journalism in that respect, led to the end of the Vietnam War.
Kirsten Dunst's character says something like that
she
in the
does.
Film.
She does. She talks about it. Yeah, precisely. But she is being faced with something which relates to the Watergate issue, which is she's been risking her life and sending these messages home. But it hasn't stopped anything. The warning is, don't do this.
Don't let it happen here.
Don't let it happen here. But she is not gaining traction. It's all of that danger and all of that suffering observed of other people and suffering that she has felt herself has been futile. And so it's an existential problem she's dealing with. And that is the Watergate problem, which is that if that story was reported now, would it change things in the way it needs to change things? No, it wouldn't. And then you've got a younger journalist who is just starting out and is in a way full of a kind of puppyish idealism, I suppose, and also not thinking through all of these consequences and dangers. The older journalist is trying to dissuade the younger one from doing it for their own safety, but also because why risk your life if it's going to be futile? Just don't do it.
Yeah, I'm glad to get to hear that from you because it is interesting. Working with my colleagues here who've often risked their lives in war zones.
Because this is one of the things that is incredibly frustrating for me about the one thing I have said in interviews before, but I'm going to say it again, which is when I told people I was going to make a film, particularly a guy in the film industry, I said, I want to make a film where journalists and the heroes are the heroes. And they said, don't do that. Everybody hates journalists. And it freaked me out, absolutely freaked me out, because journalists are like doctors. You do need them. You don't want bad doctors. You don't want doctors you can't trust. Mm-hmm. But you do want doctors who can fix problems when the problems need fixing. I would say right now there are problems of exactly the sort that journalism is required to fix. Mm. So I get not exactly conspiracy theorist, but I start to look at who is undermining trust in journalism and why.
I'm Tom Power. You're listening to Q. You're in the middle of my conversation with Alex Garland, the celebrated writer and director. We're talking about his new film, Civil War, which is about what would happen if there was an American Civil War now. And I can tell you that, like, it's an America you recognize in the film. New York still exists, but you don't really know why the war is happening. You do know there's four factions to the war, not just two. There's the Western Forces, the New People's Army, the Loyalist States, and the Florida Alliance. Alex in the film doesn't get into what these factions believe or why they're fighting the war. We're not really sure what the issues are or who's against whom. I wanted to ask him why. You said something very something interesting earlier that I wanted to ask you about anyway, which you said you wanted this film to in some ways be reporting. You didn't want to give away too much. And I had a question about this.
Sure.
Because I'm sort of two minds about it. So I should say, for people who haven't seen the film, if you're expecting some sort of film where it's explicitly explained why the U.S. is in a civil war, you're not necessarily going to – you're gonna not going to find that.
Are you WF? Who's giving you orders?
No one's giving us orders, man. Someone's trying to kill us. We are trying to kill them.
You don't know what side they're fighting for.
You know that it's Texas and California have banded together. You know that there are other states having banded together. You know that the president is in a third term. You know that he disbanded the FBI. You know that he has killed American citizens. But it's not incredibly clear the motivations behind it. Now, the reason you can see I'm sort of struggling with it is because I can't tell whether that's an interesting decision on your part not to tell us too much, or if I'm used to films telling me everything. Do you know what I mean? Like, if I'm used to much...
Can't it be both?
Yeah, I guess so. But so much exposition that, like, this is the reason behind it, no room for subtlety. Maybe what you could do is just talk me through to the decision of how much you wanted to give away of why America was in a civil war in the first place and the details of it.
Well, one thing is I think that I make assumptions on the audience, and one of the assumptions I make is they know. They know the answer to that question already. I don't need to say it. There's another thing that sometimes by naming things, like I could see why an uncharitable slash stupid, actually, criticism might be that it's an act of, as it were, cowardice or abdication of political responsibility.
To not say these are the reasons why. This is the warning.
But there are many things. But one of them is there are political statements that relate not to what people disagree about, but what they agree about. And a broad sense that I have that most people are not extremists, but extremists have a loud voice. And it is in a way speaking to those people. So in Texas and California being on the same side. And I should just say, you said it's not explicitly described. You're right, it is not, but it is implicitly described. There are dots that could quite straightforwardly be drawn together if one wanted to.
I'm used to someone going like, hey, Texas and California are together, buddy, you know why?
You
and
are,
there's a PowerPoint.
Texas and California.
I'm being glib, yeah.
But it's what you're saying is true. Film has relied on being explicit for a long time, and I just question whether that is always necessary.
Right.
But also, if the intention of the film is to talk and not alienate, so to shout, at that kind of assertion is itself problematic and is part of the division that we are dealing with as an issue, right?
Right.
So it's to do with leaving a certain kind of space, I suppose. But to talk about it implicitly, then look at, as it were, the facts within a fiction context of what is being asserted. Fascist president, Texas and California joining together. We all know Texas and California have very different political positions. Mm-hmm. So clearly what they're doing is they are saying our political differences are less important, are less serious than the threat of a president who is undermining the Constitution, intimidating or threatening journalists, removing systems of law that might threaten them in the terms of the film, the FBI. Mm-hmm. They are saying our political differences are lesser mm-hmm. than that problem.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that to me would be a reasonable statement and, by the way, quite possibly a true statement
mm-hmm.
because Texas and California have more in common than mm-hmm. they have different. It also implicitly, not explicitly, suggests something else, which is if you disagree with that assertion, if you're saying, no, the polarized position of Texas and California is so great that they would consider their polarized state to be more important than the problem of fascism, then that is an insane position.
Well, you're revealing about yourself. You're revealing something about yourself
absolutely,
through...
Absolutely, precisely.
Yeah,
so
yeah, yeah.
I create the film as an argument of implication that you can only reach if you think about it or talk about it. Now, I've used one example. There are many, many such examples in the film. I get there is a kind of viewer that wants things spelled out.
Mm.
There are plenty of films that they can go and see.
Mm-hmm.
Equally, there are plenty of people in public discourse making clear, polarized political statements. Again, no shortage.
Mm-hmm.
Not interested in joining either of those two camps personally. I mean, I could...
I understand.
Go on about that, but you get the point.
And I understand it from the perspective of you talking about this film as a version of reporting as well. There's been some made about your dad's job. Your dad was a political cartoonist.
Right.
I actually looked up some of your dad's cartoons.
Oh, he'll be delighted.
There's one I really loved of, I think it's Gorbachev and Reagan arm wrestling,
yeah.
and then that leading to them shaking hands.
Right.
I thought that was a really lovely one.
Oh, Dad will be delighted. I'll tell.
And I know there's journalists in your family. I know your godfather was a journalist.
Yeah.
I think your younger brother's godfather was a journalist.
Correct,
so there was journalism in the house. But political cartoonists are a different breed. I remember when I was, maybe they are. I just remember when I was reading the paper growing up,
mm-hmm.
I would read, my dad was a voracious, you know, paper reader of the Telegram back home. And I remember, you know, I would read the news of what's going on with the fishery and what was going on politically.
Mm-hmm.
And then I would get this small sliver of someone's opinion. Now, opinion wasn't, someone said to me the other day, like back in those days, we called people who had a lot of opinions opinionated. There wasn't a lot of opinion. There were letters to the editor,
yep,
an editorial
yep,
note.
Absolutely.
But there was the political cartoon.
Yep.
What do you learn growing up with a political cartoonist as a dad?
Well, one thing I learned was that, you know, his job was to, in a way, distill something, you just described it, into a pictorial form. And he would try and do it in a balanced and complex way, but that was also assertive. And in some respects, you could see this film as being like a political cartoon writ large.
That's what I was wondering about.
I have not had that thought until you suggested it. In fact, I did not have the thought you did. And that's another thing I'll tell Dad. He'll also be delighted about that. But the real thing I learned was his analysis, that he is... reasonable. And in fact, I've gone on a kind of journey myself, and I've ended up, and this happens with people, I think, over the course of their life. As they get older, they end up being like their parents, politics, maybe.
Yeah.
I would have always said I was left-wing. Mm-hmm. And in a way, I am left-wing. If you were to talk to me about free markets or taxation or things like that, I would be left of center for sure. But what I've realized is that mainly what I am is a centrist. And I get that from my dad. And I think the realization comes from understanding that the function of government, the function of states, which I would have always seen as to make life better for their citizens, I now realize is not. That's their secondary goal. Their primary goal is to not be fascists.
Right.
That's the main thing they have to do.
That's the main aspiration.
That's the main aspiration. And that is the aspiration of centrist democracy, because the system that exists of checks and balances, executive, judiciary, legislature, and the fourth estate, the journalists who are holding those to account, those things exist. The checks and balances exist to prevent extremism. That's why they're there, to stop corruption, to stop manipulation of the system, to stop authoritarian behavior. And I can see them being eroded, all four of those things being eroded. And I can see, I really believe, however some people will think this is naive, but however alarmist it might sound, I can see fingerprints of fascism appearing in all sorts of different places and the guarding systems being diminished. And I suddenly realized, oh, I'm a centrist. I really am a centrist. So within that come all sorts of strange sort of sub-realizations for me personally. And anyway, to relate it to Dad, yeah. I think Dad would probably describe himself as that as well.
I'm Tom Power. You're listening to Q. More of my conversation with the filmmaker Alex Garland after this.
Think of your favorite one-hit wonder.
Or that overpriced toy your parents would never let you have.
Or that TV show that no one else remembers because it was canceled way too soon. Now, what if we could fix it? I'm Francesca Ramsey.
And I'm DeLon Grant. And after 20 years of friendship, we are now hosting a new nostalgia podcast called Let Me Fix It.
Each episode, we'll dig into our favorite celebrities, shows, and brands of yesteryear, and then imagine what it would take to repackage them for relevance today.
Think of our show as an intervention, but with way less stakes.
So subscribe to Let Me Fix It wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
Hey, I'm Tom Power. You're listening to Q. You're in the middle of my conversation with writer and director Alex Garland about his new film, Civil War. It's been getting a lot of attention online, and you got to expect it because check out the premise. It follows a team of journalists on this kind of terrifying road trip through the U.S. as they're experiencing a civil war, like in our time. And they're trying to make it to Washington, D.C. to interview the president who's disbanded the FBI and started attacking American citizens. And he's beginning to lose his grip on power. So they're trying to make it to D.C. to reach him for an interview. Alex, if you don't know him, is a guy known for fiction, right? He made this novel called The Beach, which did really well. Films like Ex Machina and Annihilation, screenplays like 28 Days Later and Sunshine. And his dad was this really well-known political cartoonist in the UK. And in the first part of our conversation, I don't know if you caught it, it's a lot about like his thoughts, like Alex's thoughts on journalism and the media and fascism and polarization. And for all he was going to say about that, I was curious, you know, for a guy who talks that way and thinks so deeply about the world that we're living in and comes from a family of newspaper reporters and journalists, why didn't he go into journalism himself? And he told me something that he had never told anyone. Here's more of our conversation. Why do you write fiction? Why didn't you write, you know?
I almost exclusively read nonfiction.
Because this sound, you sound science. To me like somebody who would be on the path to, you know?
Oh, I would love to write fiction, to write nonfiction, excuse me. It's very difficult. It's very, very hard.
Nonfiction.
It's very hard. It's harder than writing fiction. There's so much latitude in fiction. With nonfiction, you should have an obligation, a sort of internal obligation to tell the truth. And I can manipulate a story to suit my own ends, I suppose. I can, in other words, I can lie in order to get to what I think of as a truth.
Right.
But someone writing nonfiction cannot lie at any point along that process, or they shouldn't.
Aspirationally, again.
Aspirationally. Yeah, clearly, course. some of them do.
Yeah, right. Was there a track? Were you once thinking I'm going to be a journalist? Did you learn what you just told me through experience?
Not only was there a track, this is pretty embarrassing in many ways, actually, but there is an element of autobiography in this film that I haven't spoken about before, and now I'm mortifying myself by starting to talk about it. When I was late teens and early 20s, I thought, I am going to become a foreign correspondent. And so very eccentrically, rather sort of bizarrely, I would go to foreign countries, I would blag or fake a press card, and I would attend what I thought was the most dramatic thing going on, which might be a demonstration or some sort of raid, or I'd tag along with local journalists and stuff like that. All thinking I was going to end up at some point, somehow, by force of will, as a foreign correspondent. That's what I thought, what I imagined would happen. I mean, listen, I was like 19, 20 years old, and I was definitely wrong. And then a couple, but one in particular, very, very experienced war correspondent who was observing this, did in effect what Lee in the film does to Jesse, the younger journalist in the film, and says, you need to cut that out. And here's why. The difference was I listened. I thought, yeah, no, you're right. I should cut it out. Because I didn't have the hero in the film. I didn't have their courage. So, yeah, I cut it out.
You were kind of scared. You were in these foreign courts. You were with the...
No, I was actually worse than that. If I'm really, really honest,
yeah,
it was worse than that. It wasn't that I was scared. In a funny way, it's that I wasn't scared. It's that I wasn't taking it seriously. I was treating it in the way a young person might treat it, not with the seriousness it deserved. I was, in some respects, indulging in a childish fantasy. You know, now that I'm older, I look back on it and it sort of, I've got kids that were older than I was back then. So I sort of get it in a different kind of way. But it was also pretty stupid in various ways. And in fact, obliquely, this is how I work. I then ended up writing a book about it, because the first book I wrote is The Beach, which is really about the nature of vicarious adventure seeking when you are young not really. And where does the imagery come from that is creating the adventure you're trying to seek? And how much are you really thinking about the place you are in as opposed to your fantasy version of the place you are in? That's, to me, privately, that's what The Beach is about. And that's why fiction works for me, because I can sort of mutate these things into a story that works in my own terms. I'm 53, nearly 54. I've never said that before.
I appreciate it.
It's because I find it mortifying. It's because I find it embarrassing. It's actually because I find it embarrassing, because I think back on my behavior and what I was doing in it. I find it slightly chilling, but also because I'm 53, I think, okay, but you were basically a kid. It's okay.
You got to have compassion for that. You know what I mean? You were just a youngster, you know? We're all, you know?
Fine, I'll take it.
I'll send the check in the mail.
Okay.
It does lead me to a sort of a theory
it's probably
I had
about a year's worth of therapy.
I'm very affordable. I can tell you that much. It does lead me to something I was wondering about your work in general, which I was sort of nervous about asking you, but I feel a little bit more comfortable doing it now, which is about. Well, I was reading an interview with you when Annihilation came out, and there was a line you said, I don't have it quoted verbatim, but you said, you know, a through line through your work is identity. And you were talking about how in Annihilation, you were thinking about identity through self-destruction.
I thought I was a man. I had a life. People called me Cain. But now I'm not so sure. I wasn't Cain, what was I? Was I you? Were you me?
And I was just thinking, when you were talking about The Beach just then, is it the place that I'm in, the way that I'm relating to other people, or is it about my own sort of idea of myself? I could go to Ex Machina and talk a little bit about the identity of, are we human and what makes us human? You know, I could talk about it mm-hmm. in Men, and I could talk about it in Civil War when it comes to my identity as my thoughts and my ideas. What has you interested in identity?
Oh, aren't we all a bit? I mean, one of the things is
that, but we don't all make films about it, you know?
No. Somehow, as a byproduct of the thing we were just talking about, I ended up as a writer, as a novelist. I didn't ever think that would happen. Then suddenly, I'm now a professional fiction writer, writing books, and then writing screenplays. And all those things are acts of processing, sort of observing something and processing it. And what I think is that a lot of what I think about is, it is nothing more than what we all think about, whether we are aware we're thinking about it or not.
What's that?
Well, what we are. What does something mean? Like you said, self-destruction. Why is self-destruction so common as an act, as a piece of behavior?
Yeah.
Why is that so common? It is ferociously common. Mm. You know, is it that we all know we're going to die, and that's got nothing to do with the religious position? You could be religious or not religious, you still know you're going to die. Mm-hmm. Is it like acquiring a bit of agency over this? We know this is going to happen to us, so we are going to play a part in that. Or is that a rationalization? And then I think unconsciously people are preoccupied by that. It can come out in strange ways. So they watch films or read books or whatever it is, TV shows, about people who are unconcerned with risk to themselves, like James Bond mm-hmm. or something. What is James Bond carrying out on our behalf? What are post-apocalyptic narratives with zombies? What are they giving us? Now, in a way, the success of those genres would suggest that people are preoccupied by it, whether they know they're preoccupied or not.
You know, you and I were talking a little bit about polarization, and I love this quote I read with you where you said you should think about Civil War as polarization as the cause of this and not the symptom of it. But polarization comes up in the receiving of the film. You had people on the right talking about the film and what it could possibly mean. You had people on the left talking about the film and what it could possibly mean. How do you guard yourself from that? Do you turn your phone off and ignore all of it, or are you also looking at the way that people are receiving your work?
I do avoid it, but at the same time, there does seem to be something quite aggressive in me, I think, because these films are often acts of aggression in some respects, because to take that amount of money to make a film, I don't mean personally, I mean to make it, just in the case of Annihilation,
it's a big budget
is its
film.
Own form of self-destructive act in a funny kind of way, or destructive act to the people that gave you the money. I don't know.
Right.
There is something highly aggressive, really, in truth, about making a film called Civil War, about America collapsing into a state of civil war. I can see that as an aggressive act. Some people on the far right and some people on the far left mm-hmm. will dislike an attack on polarization, mm-hmm. but I dislike them. So I'm in some respects picking a fight. Part of the aggression is, yeah, bring it on, mm-hmm. idiots. Mm-hmm. You know, bring it on, morons. You are actually inflaming each other. And the place you are taking us all is bad. I'm not interested. I'm not joining your game. I'm not going to be a polarizer. I'm going to say the polarizers, both of them, are problematic and separate myself from them. But I have to say, I'm not making this film accidentally. I have a position. I am concerned,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
I am concerned. Mm-hmm. So I'm taking a position against things that I, on an ideological level, disagree with.
Lovely to meet you. Thanks for coming in.
Likewise.
After that conversation was over, one of our producers here in Q walked into the studio, looked at me and said, I feel like you just got a PhD in something. That's my conversation with the writer and director, Alex Garland. His new movie, Civil War, is in theaters now. If you know someone who would love to hear that conversation, subscribe to our podcast, Q with Tom Power, and send it along. Tom Power. You're listening to Q here on CBC. Hamza Haq is an award-winning Canadian actor who became really well-known for this medical drama, a Canadian medical drama called Transplant. It's an interesting story because I remember talking to Hamza right when the show got on the air, and he was telling me that up until that show went on the air, he didn't have a whole lot going on. He was sort of consistently being offered roles as cab drivers or convenience store owners, you know, stereotypical stuff, right? And he told his agent, enough is enough. I want a role where I can it's meaty, I can play a complex character, I want dimension, you know, in the next role I play. So then the audition for the show Transplant comes up. He gets the role of Dr. Bashir Hamed. They call him Bash on the show, and he's a resident who fled the war in Syria. That role changes Hamza Haq's life. Transplant becomes a rare thing, which is a Canadian medical drama that is a bona fide hit. But it became a bona fide hit while, and I'll tell you about this, while Hamza couldn't leave his house because of COVID-19. So on the heels of a series finale and the release of his new film, With Love and a Major Organ, Hamza Haq joined me from the side of the road. He was driving from Toronto to Montreal to talk about it. I started by asking about having to watch the show's success from the sidelines.
In retrospect, I'm so grateful for COVID. like out of context, this is going to get me canceled. Yeah. But like, I'm going to
isolate that and just play it by itself.
Yeah, exactly. Next week on Q, I'm so grateful for COVID. but the thing, like what happened was that I had, you know, we were being told all these things like, okay, you're going to have this premiere and it's so good. And we saw some of the episodes and NBC is going to air it and you're going to be on these shows and whatever. And then when COVID happened, it just grounded the world, right? I'm just speaking to my experience of it. Like a week after the show launched, I was back in my parents' house and like literally in my childhood bedroom, unemployed and not being able to participate in how grand the show became. So like, it wouldn't have been of service to me. And moving forward, I couldn't have been of service to the show because I would have believed the hype of like, yo, we're stars now.
Yeah,
guys.
You would have bought a leopard print Cadillac.
No, I would have bought a leopard. And so I'm grateful I didn't for my benefit and the leopard.
Okay. So the thing kind of takes off while you're isolated from everybody else. You're unable to go on the couch with, you know, Jimmy Fallon. You're just sort of watching it sort of happen all around you. How do you feel when you find out that it's ending?
It's complex, right? You build your entire life around this thing for a while. We have 8-month production schedule. It just becomes, it's like leaving university. Like it's just, well, okay, now I have to do the next thing.
Imaging showed pulmonary edema, but no underlying causes.
When did her symptoms present?
A few days ago when she got here from Turkey, I did a screening for possible infections she could have picked up, but nothing.
In addition to the crew and to the experience of filming it, the character itself is an interesting one, and I'm always really interested in whether or not people take things with them from their characters after embodying them for so long. I mean, your character has a lot of integrity. He has a lot of humility. He cares about his family. He cares about his patients really deeply. He takes risks for what he believes in. Is there anything you're going to carry with you from playing this character? Do you feel changed by playing the character?
Yeah, I'm going to try. You know, like these are all like admirable qualities, and you know, I think you hit the nail on the head with humility. Like, you know, we think there's this weird self-importance that we put on ourselves, like especially as actors, and like everybody does it to a certain degree. You know what I mean? Like, I used to work at the government, and somebody who was like one level up was, you know, than me was. You know, we would also put that on self-importance, and we have to, like, you know, like the ego response to it's a survival mechanism, you know, to feel good about yourself. Yeah. And it's necessary.
And want the approval of our peers and others.
Yeah, you know what I mean? Not just the approval, but the admiration of our peers. Like, I love that, you know? But I think with Bash, like, he... And this is a comment about the... so many of the people that I got to talk to who had been through what Bashir had gone through as a result of the war in Syria, and who people who were refugees and came to Canada, and the types of conversations that I had the opportunity to have as a result of not just my research on the show, but because of the success of the show, I was invited to do panels and yada, yada. You know what I mean? That, like, the fact that you can go through something so harrowing and still have a mentality that you are still in service to something else. Like, so many times I'm like, the most minor inconvenience for me, I'm just like, God, man, people should be bending to my, you know what I mean? But as opposed to, like,
I own a leopard. Just like,
yeah, you know, yeah, exactly. You know what I mean? But, like, you know, I think what I have learned and continue to learn and try to implement in my life is that, like, I just have to be in service to whatever's happening. Like, I don't control the world. I control my response to that. And that's something, what was awesome is that Bashir struggles with that. You know, there's a nobility about him, you know, about the doctor and his struggle and his trauma and everything like that, that, you know, that sort of honed this character. But it was like, you know, he would put himself in increasingly more dangerous situations because he thought he could control it. But the whole show is about him releasing that control and just being humble enough to be like, I don't actually control any of this, and I just have to forgive myself, you know, that what I got to do on camera was me getting to practice that. And then, you know, much in the way that in season 4, I got to practice saying goodbye to this thing that he had done for 4 years. And I'm just like, I actually don't have to mourn the show privately. What you see me doing in season 4, saying goodbye to these people that I love, leaving the hospital and feeling both the excitement of starting something new and the grief of letting something that he's grown to love go, that is me processing saying goodbye to transplant in real time. So I actually didn't have to do it.
Madiha just got to Canada with her family. She's shaken from her journey and this huge change in her life, and if I'm honest, she's me. She's me 7 years ago, and she's me right now, wondering if everything I went through was for nothing.
If you're just tuning in, my guest is Hamza Haque. We've been talking about the end of the hit Canadian show, Transplant. Before we go, it's exciting to see you in something very, very different than what I've seen you in. You're in this new film called With Love in a Major Organ. It's about this sort of alternate world where hearts are made out of objects, and this film follows a woman who rips her heart out for the man she loves, played by you, only to discover that he's run away with it. I'll tell you this, Hamza, I don't want to give too much away, but, like, this is a surreal film. This is a bizarre film. It's a daring film. It's a really interesting, very cool film. It's unlike anything I've seen you in. How deliberate was this choice? Did you want to be in something a little bit different? Tell me what it was like to step into a role like this.
It's always both, like, tremendously deliberate and just chaotic, right? And, like, these things happen and you deliberately choose to roll with that chaos. I think that's as much as I can sum it up.
Right.
I always want to do something different in that I want to do everything. Like, I'm such a glutton for acting. Like, I want every part. I want every part all the time. So when this came across, like, I'd read it and I thought it was hilarious. And then I read it again. Oh, man, I'm like editing myself. So, like, I took an edible and it was hilarious, right? Yeah. And then I woke up.
You don't
up
have
in the
to edit yourself. It's okay. It's the new CBC. It's the, you know, you it's know, it's, yeah, it's exactly. The 2024 CBC. It's okay.
It's just, I know, but I'm just like,
I have a beard.
Like, my dad has me on Google Alerts, and he's going to read this interview, and he's going to be like, you know what I mean? He's going to hear it.
I get so, it. I get it. I understand. Yeah, okay. Anyway, okay. Not on my end. I get it. You know.
Okay. Yeah. So he'll learn this. Hi, Dad. And so, like, so hopefully he doesn't know what that is. But, like, so I had a piece of chocolate. I read it. I thought it was hilarious. And then I woke up in the morning and I read it again, and it was still funny. And, but it was a tough role because, like you said, like, you know, we talk about Bashir's humility. I think George, first name and last name, George he's an incredibly humble man because he doesn't like a lot of things about his life. He doesn't he's a sad person. He understands that he's not where he wants to be. There's things about himself that he doesn't like. And he's so okay with it. Like, he has accepted all the realities in his life.
It's an interesting, I mean, it's a really beautiful, surreal film. Mm-hmm. But it does, and maybe this is a good way to close things off, it does lead me to a really interesting situation that you're in right now. I mean, as you mentioned, Canadian medical dramas don't typically become a massive hit the way that this did with you as the lead. But given that you sort of have defied the normal path of a Canadian actor, what do you, I know this is a big question, but what do you want the rest of your career to look like?
So the rest of my career, I don't know, man. I just hope that I get to play characters that are beautiful in all of their brokenness, that are challenging, that I learn more about myself, that are Pakistani, that can be, you know, Muslim, that are, you know, not just that, but, it, you know, up to and including. If you say that, like, a normal trajectory for a Canadian actor who was on, you know, I don't feel like I fit that category, because in any way you slice it, I'm one generation away from extreme poverty. My dad pulled his family out of a very dire situation. And you know, I grew up in the Middle East thinking that I would be a doctor. And then I immigrated to Canada when I was 9. And then I found acting in grade 6, you know, through drama class. And then I just fell ass backwards into an acting class, and I've had the same coach, Michelle Lonsdale Smith, for 12 years, and we have sort of cultivated this thing together, and I fell in love with acting in a way that made me fall in love with myself. So I don't know if I fit any category. I've never felt like I have. I'm not the typical Canadian. I'm not the typical Muslim. I'm not the typical Pakistani. So, like, whatever it's going to be, as weird as it is, it's really going to fit the mold of how my life has been. And I'm grateful for that.
I mean, what a beautiful answer. It's been so amazing to see, kind of talk to you at the very beginning of this thing and kind of see how amazingly things turned out. Thanks so much for making the time for us. Go back on the road. Thanks a lot for talking to us.
Thank you so much, Tom. And thank you to everybody at Q Studio.
My conversation with Hamza Haq, who joined me after pulling off on the side of the road driving from Toronto to Montreal, because here at Q, we believe safety first. His new film, With Love and a Major Organ, is in theaters now. You can watch season 4 of Transplant on CTV and Crave. What a tune. All morning we've been talking, Gabby, Matt, and I have been here in the studio, have been talking about what a jam of jams Into Deep by Sum 41 is. Sum 41 stopping. I don't know if you heard the news. So tomorrow on the show, the front man and the voice you're listening to right now of Sum 41, Derek Whibley, will be here for the first time to talk about not knowing when he was writing their most recent record that it would be their last. He'll tell you how he came to that decision and how he told the band. That's tomorrow on Q. We'll see you soon. Later on. Maybe we're just trying too hard when really it's closer than it is too far.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.